Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast. I'm your host, Michael Jordan. I appreciate you being here. I just finished a great conversation with Larry Lepard, who I think is one of the best at articulating the macroeconomic challenges that we face both in the United States and globally. And I wanted to use this conversation to clarify my understanding of what the challenges were as a non-finance guy and make sure that I was just clear that that I understood sort of beyond just the basic concepts. And Larry, as I would have expected, completely delivered on this, and it was an awesome conversation. I think you'll enjoy it as well. All right, everyone. Like I said in the intro, I've got Larry here with me. Larry, welcome to the show.
Nice to be with you, Michael. Looking forward to this conversation.
Yeah, me too. Believe me. If I see your name on a podcast, it'll be listened to very quickly. So this is a lot of fun for me. Yeah. Normally I'm going to want to jump in and hear your thoughts on a lot of things. If you'll indulge me, I'd like to spend the first 90 seconds of me actually explaining my understanding as a non-finance person of some of the situation we're in, and then you correcting, editing, and filling in the blanks on anything I'm missing.
That sounds great. Go for it.
So the long story short of our fiscal situation, as I understand it, is that the federal government spends more than it brings in, right? On foreign wars, social programs, you name it. Yeah. And essentially, it has two options for funding these deficits that it creates. It can digitally print money, as it did with COVID, as I understand it, or it can sell bonds and take on more and more debt. And usually it's taking on debt, and we see lots of debt being issued these days. So over time, less people want to buy our debt for a number of reasons. We weaponize it at times, we freeze assets, high inflation has crushed, you know, returns in the bond market. And this makes it harder to pay off old debt because people aren't buying new debt for us to then pay off the existing debt. So the debt increases exponentially. The interest on the debt expense alone, I think right now, is over $1 trillion for the first time.
Yeah.
And so eventually the options sort of become, you can do austerity, you can raise taxes, you can cut expenses, which seems very politically unlikely, but you could hypothetically do that. You can default and say, hey, sorry, we can't pay you back, or we can only pay you 30 cents on the dollar, or 50 cents on the dollar, or something. Or eventually you print money to pay bondholders and accept that there's going to be this ensuing inflation. Is that directionally?
You pretty much got it. I mean, you've got all the important pieces of it. There really isn't much there that I would change. They have created a mess for themselves. And what's kind of stunning to me, and it's just a function of the fact that we are the reserve currency, and for so many years we behaved in a more responsible fashion, is that the dollar hasn't, you know, taken a bigger hit, and that the bond market still kind of exists. Because, you know, we're seeing inflation. Some people obviously think inflation is going back to 2%. I don't. And it needs to go back to 2% to have, you know, any, for it to make any sense for anyone to buy a 10-year bond yielding 4-point-something. So, I think you've correctly identified the breaking point here is going to be the bond market. And you've also identified the two, you know, the things there, they do have levers they could pull. They could, you know, reform Social Security, stop the foreign wars, reduce expenses. You know, there are a lot of things they could do, increase taxes, whatever. None of which they've done, none of which they have any interest in doing. In fact, it appears they're going the other direction, and try to balance the budget. But it's pretty far out of balance right now. And so to do any of those would be politically very unpopular. So here we are, you know, as you point out, the interest expense, you know, this was all well and good when interest rates were incredibly low and the government could issue debt, and the cost to them on an annualized basis of the interest was modest. I mean, there was a time not that far back in the recent, you know, past when, you know, the interest expense of the federal government was $300 or $400, you know, billion dollars a year. Today, I think it's actually running at a rate above 1 trillion. I think it's running closer to 1.2, 1.3 trillion, and headed higher, because the average cost on all that debt is in the low threes. And yet most of the bond market and the bill market is up in the 4 and 5 range. So as these things roll over, you know, even if we weren't adding to the deficit, and we are, I estimate that we're adding at least two trillion a year to the deficit, arguably more. The interest costs are going to get higher and higher. So it really is kind of a debt death doom loop that, And this is not it's not something that's terribly unusual. I mean, the world has seen these kinds of things before. It's just that it's typically seen them in seen it in developing countries, developing economies. It hasn't seen it like this with the world, the largest economy in the world and the world's reserve currency. And so that's what makes this one so interesting and challenging because, there's a lot of history that says, this shouldn't happen with a reserve currency, and yet it's happening. So.
So is there a case to be, so I completely understand why as like an individual investor, you'd never hold long-term federal, government debt.
Right.
Is the reason that the bond market is being held up because of foreign investors who don't have access to dollars so readily that need dollars for, global trade. So much global trade is done is debt is denominated in dollars, and so they need it for other purposes. Is that what's sort of
That's
keeping the
some of
system
it,
afloat?
although the foreign holdings have decreased. I mean, on balance, foreign holders have decreased since 2014. It's a subtle decrease. It's not like they've all dumped it all at once. And Japan and China still own large blocks of our debt, but it's not growing anymore. There was a time when, the U.S. 10-year was the most secure, risk-free asset in the world, and so we could issue it as much as we wanted and didn't have a problem getting people to buy it. For just the reasons you've described, they were buying commodities and other things that were dollar priced, and so they needed to have a dollar-based savings vehicle, and the U.S. Treasury worked out real well. I think what's going on is people are realizing that they're holding a burning match, and so yes, I mean people are, the trend, and it's just a trend, it's not absolute, but the trend is away from foreigners holding the debt.
And you think that is a trend that will continue and
I
event
do.
and
I
so
do. In fact,
yeah.
arguably, it's gonna get worse. I think that, I mean, this is kind of like smoke in the theater. I mean, as more and more people realize what's going on here, and the fact that the U.S. financial condition really isn't very good and unlikely to get better, rates will go higher, the deficit will, the interest costs will go higher, the deficit will get bigger, rinse, wash, repeat, right? It's just kind of, and pretty soon it'll be kind of like, you don't want to be the last person out the door. If the theater's on fire, look, we're not at that stage yet. People are moving away from it, but it's not a panic yet in any sense of the word. But it's not inconceivable that over time, if the U.S. doesn't get its fiscal house in order and does continue to print money effectively by monetizing things and growing the Fed balance sheet, that more and more people are going to reach the conclusion that, Bitcoin holders and gold holders have already reached, which is this is broken and unlikely to get fixed. Yeah.
So your thesis then is that at the end of the day, however it plays out, effectively what will need to happen or what will be done is money printing to pay back these debt holders, not a
Sadly, yes,
default or
because the alternative is to have a hard default and just say, oh, sorry, we're not going to pay back the debt, or to stop the money supply growth and let tons and tons of industries and companies fail. That was kind of what happened in the 20s, 1929, the Great Depression. They blew a big bubble and it burst, and then when it burst, they couldn't get the money out fast enough. And so, the after effects were large. I mean, that's the alternative. I mean, if they were to suddenly stop monetizing the debt, we'd see cascading defaults across all kinds of asset classes. So, they have to continue. It's the Keynesian lie. They have to continue to grow everything, to have the system work. It's like a shark. It's got to move to breathe. So as a result of that, they're going to grow the money supply. They're going to grow the currency units out there, and that's why investors need to hold things which the government can't print.
So, and that starts to take shape then, monetizing the debt takes shape when we have, there are an inadequate number of buyers of new debt to
Correct.
pay off the
Right.
existing base,
Correct. I mean,
the debt base.
if interest rates really start to spike out like they did last fall when the 10-year went over 5%, Fed came out with 12 speakers in 10 days and said, oh, no, rate hike cycle's over. We're going to be cutting rates. And the 10-year immediately fell back down to below 4%. I mean, that was a good case of jawboning rates lower, but that can only work so many times. And so my sense is that what will happen is interest rates will spike up. And in they will have to either, cut rates to reduce, the federal deficit, or they'll have to engage in yield curve control. And they've kind of got a soft yield curve control going on right now. I mean, Janet Yellen has started, the Treasury has started buying off the run longer dated treasuries that are illiquid. And they claim this is just quote unquote to help liquidity in the market. And the amounts are small. So it's not a big number yet. But the point is they've greased the rails for this kind of behavior. And yes, they will. I mean, what we know, and this is the core of the investment thesis of all of us sound money folks, is that when push comes to shove, they will do whatever it takes to keep the system going, even if that means potentially very high inflation. And we've seen this over and over again. They did it in 08, should have let all the banks fail. They should have had a big downturn, but they didn't do it. They said the ATMs weren't going to work. They printed a ton of money. They did it in 2019 with a repo blowout. Powell pivoted, printed a ton of money. They did it in March of 2020, printed a ton of money. They did it with Silicon Valley Bank, printed a ton of money. So the Fed mandate is, full employment and low inflation. Their full employment, they're okay on that, at least in the doctored statistics that they show us that, employment rate's not terrible. Unemployment rate's not terrible. But the inflation, they obviously failed, terribly on the mandate when COVID came around. And so, but the third unwritten mandate that we all know exists and the market knows exists, and it's why gold and Bitcoin are front running them, is that when push comes to shove, they will print. And so even though the Federal Reserve balance sheet, it went from 800 to 3 trillion under Bernanke, then it came back down a little bit, then it went from 3 trillion to 9 trillion. On the COVID episode, now it's come back down into the sevens. I mean, the next one will take us from 7 to 15. They'll have to print so much money their eyes are going to bleed. I mean, it's because that's what a system like this, requires. I mean, this is my pinned tweet on Twitter that, it says that and shows that if you grow the level of debt you're carrying at a rate in excess of the level of underlying GDP growth, eventually you have a crisis. Either the debt has to collapse in value, or you have to have massive inflation to bring the GDP number up to a level where it can service the debt. And it's Stein's law. If it can't go on forever, it's going to end. So, that's the regime we live under. The difficult part is, we know with very high probability that they are going to print to keep the system going. We know that that's, monetary debasement. We know that that's inflationary. We know that sound assets, sound money assets will do well. That's the good news. The bad news is we don't know what the time scale is, and we don't know the path. And what they tend to do is they've got it, they tend to get everybody calmed down. And I mean, Silicon Valley Bank, actually, I thought that was going to kick off another, big round of money printing, and it kind of did. But they managed to, create a facility and put everything back into the can, and no bank runs. So, but there are a lot of CRE assets that are failing, and I think there's a big hidden, problem out there in commercial real estate that'll come into the banking system. And there's been rumors and talk that in D.C., there, smart people in Treasury and the Fed are penciling out some kind of a commercial real estate facility that might, help banks that have troubled CRE portfolios, which it would not surprise me at all if that was going on. So what we know is that in the future they will print. But what we don't know is exactly what the timing and magnitude of that printing is. And that's because they generally speaking, they wait until there's a crisis, and then they say, well, we've got to do this. If we don't do this, the ATMs are broken. I mean, Janet Yellen at Silicon Valley Bank, Janet Yellen said, we might guarantee the entire, the FDIC limit was $250,000. What should have happened there is the Silicon Valley Bank, all the depositors, they all should have taken a haircut. I mean, that's what the black letter Dodd-Frank law said. I mean, Dodd-Frank came out after 2008, so everyone was pissed off and said, we don't want to have any more bailouts. So Dodd-Frank said, okay, the next time a bank fails, the depositors are going to take a hit. Well, maybe not, because Silicon Valley Bank failed, and all the depositors were rich and well connected, and they were from Silicon Valley, and they could call up their senators and congressmen, and they were afraid of contagion. And the U.S. banking system has $17 trillion of deposits in it. And so if you had a cascading set of bank failures, that would be systematically very threatening. And so Yellen said, well, maybe we'll guarantee all the deposits. And just saying that was enough to calm everybody down. And then creating BTFP and the FDIC loaned them a bunch of money. they calmed down further, and it's now appears to be under control. But to me, that's just that was the first, that was the first cockroach. I mean, there's certainly more cockroaches in CRE. So.
Yeah. So my financial IQ sits somewhere below room temperature. So I wanted to take a
I
step back
doubt
on so the hard default option that you said, isn't going to happen because it would just it would wreck things. Can you explain the mechanism by which? So like I think like my business exposure has been largely software technology companies, small,
sure.
more like family companies who don't have any particular financial exposure. I learned a lot with the Silicon Valley Bank and understood, oh, here's why, interest rates and these things impact companies who are more financialized, so to speak. What exactly is the mechanism? What industries are hit by that specifically? And then what are the cascading effects of a hard default? Like, I just want to better understand why that really isn't a likely option in any,
Well,
real-world scenario.
it's not a likely option primarily because all the banks would fail. I mean, if you're in the software business and, I mean, demand goes up, demand goes down, people buy software and computers, et cetera. I mean, you're not, you probably don't carry a lot of debt. You probably don't have high interest rates, on the debt, or until recently, you probably didn't have high interest rates on the debt you did carry. So, if you're a bank, I mean, you're nothing but, a money processing machine. Driven by making a spread between what you pay for your cost of money and what you lend it out at. And in a hard default, interest rates would go up, enormously and quickly. And the banks wouldn't be able to, the banks would all instantly be bankrupt. And you talk about kind of a loss of confidence. I mean, that's it. I mean, in the 30s, what happened was, thousands and thousands and thousands of banks went out of business just very, very quickly. I mean, there was no FDIC. There was no Glass-Steagall. I mean, this is what the Pecora Commission came in and fixed. But and as a result, if you were running a small business and your bank went out of business, well, guess what? You just lost all your money in the bank. Well, guess what? You have employees working in your business. You got to fire them all because you can't make payroll. And so, in the 1930s, we had 35, 40% unemployment. And I don't remember the exact specific percentage. I'm sure somebody watching the show can fill in better in the notes what the exact percentage, but we have thousands and thousands and thousands of banks failing, as a result of what happened in the 30s of the Depression. And so, that just creates enormous turmoil. I mean, and that's what they use, by the way, to get these programs through. I mean, TARP, which was an $800 billion program dreamed up by Kashkari and Paulson, that was, they were begging Nancy Pelosi. They basically said, look, if you don't give us this, all the ATMs aren't going to work tomorrow. And it was a little bit of hyperbole, but it's not entirely hyperbole because truly, if you do get cascading bank failures, I mean, think about it. Think about your life. For example, you probably have a bank account, you probably don't have an enormous amount of money in it, but what you have in there is important to you, right? And if suddenly that bank just failed and all your money were gone, what would you do? You would have to cut back on expenditures, you would have to sell something, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, the prices of real estate in the 30s fell 90%. Because people were forced into liquidating any asset that they had to try to stay alive. I mean, cash in a default and in a deflationary event like what I'm describing, cash becomes king. Nobody has any cash. There's a shortage of cash. And so so that's as you're going down this monetary road, I often say they're driving a clown car on an icy road with two guardrails and one of the guardrails is going to break, but the two guardrails are, hyperinflation and massive deflation. And the Fed's kind of bouncing off of both of them. Do you know what I mean? I mean, and not doing a very good job of it, by the way. So,
Shocking.
yeah.
So let's go back to one that makes a lot of sense. So effectively, a hard default looks something more akin to the Great Depression, and it could
Exactly.
even be a bigger
It
a
could be
bigger
bigger.
crisis.
Yeah, it could. I mean, there are those who argue that this one would be bigger.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, it's very hard to predict and to project out how it would unfold. But no, there's no doubt that if we went that route, it would be a massive negative economic event. And a lot of people would be hurt. Everyone would be hurt. I mean, the system would arguably shut down. I mean, the economic system is what, the trucks, the diesel, all it's what delivers food to people. I mean, it's if the whole system breaks down, doesn't continue to function. You could have starvation. I mean, you could have shortages of everything. I mean, it could really be an enormous humanitarian mess. And so, I get it. I mean, when confronted with that as one of the outside case possibilities, the Fed comes to the conclusion we can't have that happen. I mean, this was Bernanke's speech in 2002, the helicopter money speech, and he was a student of the Great Depression. Of course, he took away the wrong lesson from it, but ignoring that for a moment, he was a student of the Great Depression, and he basically said at Milton Friedman's birthday party, we didn't print enough money last time, but we'll never let that happen again, because we've got a money printer and we can print as much as is necessary to prevent deflation from occurring. And
Yeah, no,
so
no
that's
consequences
been,
there.
and that's, I mean, to be, he's right. I mean, he was true to his word. I mean, we had zero interest rates for 8 years, which is a crime. We had quantitative easing, which is basically just buying their own debt, which is, printing money to finance the government. I mean, it's really quite bad, and it's sad because the Fed has really painted itself into a corner here. We can talk about potential solutions in a minute, but because there are some, and I don't want to all be gloom and doom, but I can't avoid being gloom and doom insofar as I understand how these things work, and I understand the patterns of history. And it's not just me. I mean, there are a lot of other people who would suggest that this is not sustainable and there's a serious problem here.
So you said that there's no way to know exactly when like a printing event like this would need to take place, and it tends to
Right.
center around an alleged crisis.
Right.
Is there any way to think about how they would determine how much money to print? Like, are they, looking to pay, like if there's a massive drop in demand for treasuries, are they looking to pay off short, and they need to pay off short-term debt? Are they going to print just enough to do that, or are they going to print enough to just wipe out the debt? Like, how do they even think about some of
Yeah,
these
that's a
things?
great question, and it's tough to gauge. I mean, they will, I mean, their objective is to print as much as is necessary to stop the crisis. And then once the crisis, because the crises are generally kind of psychology driven, right? I mean, everyone's panicked, there's fire, let's get out of this theater. I mean, that's what happened at Silicon Valley Bank, right? I mean, they woke up one morning and half the deposits of Silicon Valley Bank disappeared in one day. I mean, this was a digital bank run. It was stunning. $47 billion went out of that bank in a day. And so that's a crisis. And, they swap lines, BTFP, Federal Home Loan Bank. I mean, I bet trillions of dollars literally went out the door trying to, just into Silicon Valley plus, First Republic and others trying to stop the panic. And they do a lot of jawboning, and Janet Yellen got out there and talked about, if necessary, we could guarantee the entire deposit base, which would have been nuts, because I mean, what are they going to guarantee 17 trillion when their balance sheet is seven? I mean, it's, pretty soon you get to the point where everyone's starting to say, hang on a second, this is all just funny money, right? But they, and in 08, as an example, I mean, they put out literally trillions and trillions of dollars in the span of when it was acute in 08. I mean, Bernie Sanders actually did a FOIA and found out, I think, like $16 trillion went out the door, in swap lines when everything was failing in 08. And so, so they come with just a fire hose and go crazy, give everybody liquidity, say, don't worry, we're not going to let anybody go bankrupt. And then once the panic has subsided, they come back and they try to withdraw it and figure out what the right level is. So it's generally speaking a two-step process. But, I like I say, I mean, typically what we've seen is, as Preston says, these contractions are getting, closer and closer together, and they're getting stronger. And so, I mean, Bernanke started off by printing a trillion and then eventually went up to three, but that took 3 years. I mean, here we are in 2020. We printed 6 trillion in 18 months, and in Silicon Valley Bank, that was kind of a small one, but we printed a lot very quickly, and then they withdrew some of it. But yeah, it's hard to say with great certainty as to, exactly what, how much they'll print, but they will print as much as it takes to do the job, and the history of this shows that typically that means more than the last time, right?
So more than, what'd you say, 6 trillion or something
Yeah,
like that?
exactly. They last, I mean, in Bernanke printed three. I mean, I'm rounding these numbers off grossly. If somebody says, hey, you're not being accurate, I'm round numbers. Bernanke printed 3 trillion. This time, we had these guys, these jokers printed, 6 trillion. I mean, why shouldn't next time be 9 or 10? So the balance sheet, Fed balance sheet today is seven. So Fed balance sheet post the next crisis will be 15, 16, 20. I don't, it sounds right. Sounds about right to me if I had to guess. And that's, Look, I mean, I get it. I mean, the alternative might be worse. I mean, it might be worse having a Great Depression, having everything collapse, having, I mean, no food deliveries, starvation, 18. I mean, that all might be worse. The only point I'm trying to make is that that what I'm describing is most certainly inflationary, highly inflationary.
Right.
And so, from an investment point of view, those of us who have some money we've saved up because we're older and we've worked all our lives, we've saved money. I mean, I've watched the money I've saved over the years get debased enormously. I mean, I used to be able to buy a new nice car for $20,000. I remember doing it, and I mean, nice cars today are 50,000 or something. I mean, it's just, I mean, I when I was a kid, gasoline was 25 cents a gallon. It's not there today.
Yeah. So,
Right.
what do you think the what kind of inflation? Well, I guess I'd just like to kind of he hear your base case for the next. So, let's say this event takes place, the printing to pay to monetize the debt,
Yeah, I
in
think
like,
it's going to happen within the next couple of years, just if you want my general
yeah,
guess. I don't think there's any way we make it more than another year or two before
and
another big print has to happen.
then is there like a lagging inflationary effect where like CPI numbers start to get out of control, or does that happen in,
It'll happen pretty quickly this time around
Okay.
because each time around, people have now figured out the drill. I mean, the one advantage they had going through them in 2008. Really, all the way up to 2020 was we kind of had a lot of good trends that were deflationary, and inflation really wasn't on the world's radar screen. We had the China price, we had all the technology and innovation, et cetera, et cetera. And so, we lived in a beautifully deflationary world from 1980 all the way to, call it, say, 2020. When the 2020 event hit and they really, I mean, I remember even in 2018, 2019, remember the Fed said, well, we're not meeting our inflation target. Inflation's zero and we want it to be 2%. I mean, they weren't meeting it, it was too low,
Yeah.
right? And 20, and they were, and then of course, when it came, oh, it's transitory. But well, then they overshot and went the other direction, right? And it went to 9 on the headline, probably higher for most people, and now it's creeping back towards 4, maybe even in the 3s. But the point is that the world is now aware of this issue, right? I mean, I don't think there's anybody in the world who hasn't noticed inflation and noticed higher prices. And when you survey people, you survey voters, anything, it's kind of like the number one concern for a lot of people because, frankly, their wages haven't gone up as fast as their costs, and they're getting squeezed. They gotta, I don't know, eat less or eat poorer, or they can't live the way they used to be able to live because things are more expensive today. It's tougher. And so people know, I think in general, people know, not all people, some people are very stupid, but those who aren't, generally speaking, know that it all is a result of what happened in the 2020 COVID crisis, all the money printing, the PPP and everything else. And because inflation is partly psychological, when the next print event occurs, and I think, as I said, I think it'll occur within 2 years. People are going to front run it, right? They're going to start hoarding things immediately, knowing that the price will be going up,
Yeah.
and it'll go up from a higher base. I mean, in the 2020 event, the base was very low, and it went to 9. I would argue the base now is probably 4, maybe it'll be 3 something, but and so and the print will be bigger, so we're going to go from 4 to, I don't know, 12. I'm just guessing, but.
Hey, just a quick break and we'll get back to the show. But I want to introduce you to our very first sponsor of the Bitcoin Way podcast, Satoshi Coffee Company. Satoshi Coffee, sats.coffee is the URL. They make high quality, fresh roasted coffee, and they even put the block number to show proof of work on each bag. If you're watching on YouTube, you can see that. I'm not a coffee snob, but I'm sort of picky about what I do enjoy. And this Satoshi blend, which is one of their more popular blends, is incredible. They also have a blend from El Salvador and a couple of others. I'd highly recommend you trying out all of them. But the cool thing about Satoshi Coffee Company is they are Bitcoin only and only accept Bitcoin as payment. And as a Bitcoin Way podcast listener, you get 6.9% off if you go to sats.coffee and enter code TBW69. Again, Satoshi Coffee Company, sats.coffee. Check them out. Support Bitcoin only companies like Satoshi Coffee Company. Yeah. So what is that your base case for? Like, if you were to just speculate on what is the highest CPI print that we see between now and 2030, and then what, And let's be honest, that's not the real rate of price inflation.
Boy, we all know they lied.
What do you think we're looking at? Are we
I
looking
don't
at real
know.
inflation of 20, 50%, something crazy like
Well,
that, or?
that's way out there. I don't know. I mean, and I don't know
Yeah.
what they'll do policy wise and everything else. I mean, they're, look, it'll definitely be in the teens. I feel very strongly about that. We will exceed the prior high of 9. And it's arguable that it'll be in the 20s. I mean, 50 is really starting to get crazy. But there's, I mean, there's a spectrum of outcomes, and it's all just probability adjusted. I mean, it really kind of depends on what they do.
Yeah.
It depends on the policy response. And there are those who argue that they could do some things that would maybe bring it back down. I mean, one of the things that I think that they didn't really think through very well is just how much these higher costs, higher rates impact one of the things that can help solve inflation. I mean, if you think about inflation, part of it's just a function of, more demand for a fixed amount of supply. And the way you increase supply is you make capital investments to produce more. And the way you make capital investments is often you either get equity capital or you borrow debt capital to create more production. And to the degree that debt capital becomes more expensive, then it's harder to add to make those capital investments and to create more production. And as a result of that, your higher rates are actually, in a way, fueling inflation. You know what I mean? It's kind of counterintuitive, but it's part of the reason why it's such a big problem. The last time we ever saw anything like this, most people are aware of the history very well, is the 70s, when we had the exact same thing. We had three waves of inflation. Each one was worse than the first. I think the last one peaked in the teens, mid-teens. And then Paul Volcker came in and he shoved interest rates up to 20%. I remember it well because it almost bankrupted my father's business. And basically created a positive real yield. And as a result of that, eventually people stopped buying gold and stopped, realized that bonds were actually returning, providing a good return for future inflation. And so, we started to recover and we got out of that cycle. But, to be frank, I mean, it was pretty brutal. And he could do that in part because the whole debt load was much lower as a percentage of the total GDP than it is today. In that time frame, the debt was 30% of GDP. Today, debt is running around 125% of GDP. And so, if we pushed interest rates, I mean, 5% interest rates hurts. I mean, just to give you an example, I mean, the U.S. federal budget, is we collect $4.5 trillion in taxes. Well, we've got $34 trillion of debt. If all that debt were paying a 10% interest rate, that would be $3.4 trillion a year in interest costs. So out of 4.4 that we collect. So, that's pre Social Security, pre right? I mean, it just doesn't, the whole thing just doesn't work. And so, what we're kind of leading to, in my opinion, is what many have described, and accurately so, in my opinion, is a sovereign debt crisis. You know, and we kicked with each of these expansionary Keynesian sets of policies, we kicked the problem upstairs, and now we're at the sovereign level. And the MMT people say, don't worry, we can print the money. But the flaw in their logic is that, sure, you can, but eventually you're going to print way too much money and nobody's going to trust the money. And Gresham's law is going to kick in. And you're going to have incredibly high inflation, arguably hyperinflation. And you're going to have to reset the currency, which is where I think we're ultimately going. Not hyperinflation per se, but we need to go to a currency reset. And some people have asked me what I would do if I were Powell. First of all, I'd resign immediately. Or I would threaten to resign by saying, I can't do this job with Congress and the legislative branch spending the way they're spending. I mean, I just can't do it because, I mean, some say the Fed drives inflation. And it does. I mean, they're hand in hand here. The Fed's kind of the drug dealer, the Congress, the addicts. But the fact is that, as long as you're going to run these deficits, you're going to have inflation. And so, after resign, I would say either they've got to get the deficit under control or I'm going to quit. And, if they wanted to go to the next step, then I would give them an education on Keynesian economics and why it's flawed. and why, we made an enormous mistake going off the gold standard in 1971, and why we need to return to a sound money standard. And Bitcoin would be the best choice by far. Gold would be an inferior but better than what we have second choice, compared to the fiat system that we currently have. And we could get things back on the basis that the money is somewhat sound, so that economic actors would do the correct the correct thing. I mean, this economy is woefully inefficient because of the fact that the money is broken. And if we did all of that, by the way, life would be a lot better for everybody. I mean, that's the everyone says, oh, that sounds really hard. That sounds really painful. That sounds like a big transition, and it is. Let's not kid ourselves. It is. We've messed the thing up pretty good. But the history of other countries that have messed the thing up pretty good and then returned to a sound money standard, it's quite encouraging what happens when you go back to a sound money standard. Things get better. They really do, and they get better quickly. Because people want to work, and they can make the right decisions, and so on and so forth. You see the efficiency distributed evenly across the society. You don't have this huge cotillionaire effect where the 1% get all the rewards, etc. So, it's that's what we should do. And I don't know. It's intriguing. I mean, I've been kind of toying around with the idea of writing a book on this topic, because kind of what's. I mean, I think Lynn Alden did a really great job with her book, Broken Money, and describing how the monetary system is broken. I'm thinking maybe trying to write something that would build upon that, where, how do we fix America? Because I really don't want to have to leave America, and I don't want to have to abandon America. I believe in America. I believe in the founding documents. I believe in the way this whole thing was set up. But we're not following any of that shit anymore. We threw it all. I mean, look, the Constitution's got gold and silver. The only things that can be money in it, and we don't do that. So, I mean, but the point is that if we kind of return, I believe that if we return back to our first principles, I mean, as an example, got out of all these foreign wars, all kinds of foreign interference, just minded our own business, we could restore this country and, regrow the industrial base. If we compete with China, compete with Russia, et cetera. We could be a great nation again, but not with the bond market the way it is. I mean, the bond market's gotta blow up, because we can't have both. Luke Roman does a good job of pointing this out. I mean, you can have a strong bond market, or you can have a country that's functioning efficiently. And in our case, because of the money being broken, we can't have a strong bond market. The bonds have got to get trashed. We've got to go to a sound currency.
Yeah. Larry, I would love for you to write a book on some of this. I think maybe what's kind of missing in my view is there are a lot of people describing how Bitcoin fixes this, the problems, a lot of really good content out there, but it's like we talk about the bright orange future, but like what does that look like and how practically is the United States sort of recreated in that image, so to speak? So I think that'd be a very interesting book. I think for me, like and maybe it's because I don't understand the finance side strongly enough, but it feels to me like the sort of canary in the coal mine over the next couple of years before people really begin to realize all the problems that we're facing that you're describing is eventually, I think some large percentage of people who don't own assets in this country, who are living paycheck to paycheck, their life literally becomes unaffordable. There's nowhere affordable to move, so they can't downsize even if they're in a modest home or apartment or whatever right now. Their groceries, they can't afford anything but Doritos and, processed garbage because that's the only thing that's cheap anymore. And when enough of those people sort of recognize I'm not alone in this, there's like the social fabric begins to break and like there's unrest. Is that some, like and that's sort of the I understand it sounds.
I think that's already happening,
Yeah,
sadly.
it's
I mean, in a
yeah.
lot, I mean, those who have decent jobs and decent incomes are hurting, but they're making it. I mean, I think the bottom half is really hurting badly. It's tragic. And unfortunately, I mean, there's some segment of that group that, I mean, all they know is they're hurting, and they blame capitalism for it, and so their solution is a socialist solution. Let's tax the rich, or let's create UBI, or whatever it might be. And what they don't understand is we really don't live in a capitalist system. We live in a crony capitalist system distorted by the oligarchs who control it all. And this is how they pulled this off and made slaves out of so many people. The hope, I believe, is that people will get educated enough on it'll get if it does get worse, people will understand why and how it got worse, and they'll get educated on why and how, and they'll vote for people who have an understanding of the alternatives. I mean, look, he's got some flaws, but I personally think RFK is by far, the strongest and best candidate for to help the overall well-being of the average American. I mean, I'm going to vote for him. I've given him money. I'm going to support him. I don't know that he can win. I think the odds are pretty long, but and there will be more. I mean, there was Ron before him, there was Ron Paul. I mean, there will be politicians who will come forward, and courageously speak the truth. And I think over time, even though the system is set up to make them to marginalize them as it did Ron Paul, over time, I think they'll have to be listened to, and so that's my hope anyway, that we can, quote unquote, vote our way out of it. Now, sadly, I'm not sure we're going to vote our way out of it until things get worse. I mean, I think it's got to be, there's got to be more pain so that more people are just, they reach that, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it any more moment. I mean, I think that's sadly, I think that's coming. I mean, it's, what do we do? I mean, gasoline right now at $5 is painful for a lot of people. I mean, the next cycle will take it to eight or nine. And I mean, it's bad. It's really bad, Michael. It's very sad. I'm very disturbed by it, and I'm very, it's not the country I grew up in. And I look at my kids who are in their 20s. They can't afford housing or buying a house, et cetera. I mean, it's a shitty deal for everybody except the oligarchs. And the reason the oligarchs do so well is they have figured out, they've cracked the code for how to cheat the system. Do you know what I mean? They're cotillionaires. They get the money first. They get it cheap. They buy up all the assets. I mean, this is, BlackRock's out there buying up housing, so that single families can't afford it, and they want to rent it back to them. I mean, it's like being sharecroppers. They want us all to be sharecroppers. So it's terrible. It's absolutely terrible.
Well,
But it's the challenge of our age, it's the challenge of our generation, it's challenge, your generation. I mean, we're gonna fix it. I mean, one is it's self-destructing as we speak. And there's some really great trends that are gonna drive what I'm describing. And I mean, the two greatest are, the internet and Bitcoin. I mean, the internet basically, created information for everybody, and made the New York Times, irrelevant. I mean, everyone can be the New York Times. I mean, it doesn't mean everyone's going to click on your website, but the point is, anyone can say anything. And I mean, Tucker Carlson and Joe Rogan have bigger audiences than some media outlets. There'll be more of that, and then so that democratizes communication and information, which is a huge deal. And then, Bitcoin democratizes money and takes it out of the hands of the state and takes it out of the hands of people who control it. It's distributed and it's fair. There's no cheating that system. And so those two things, in my opinion, will completely fix it. But, the sad part is that it's not going to get fixed tomorrow. It's going to take time. And, less sad for you because you got a long runway in front of you. You're young. More sad for me because I want to see it happen so my kids don't have to suffer any longer.
I hope you get to see some of it. Either way, I know your legacy will be strong when that time comes. So I completely understand why assets like Bitcoin and gold do well in a money printing environment. Is there a reason why something like real estate or equities, why those wouldn't do well?
Oh,
Like,
no, they're
or they
good
will?
too. They're good too. I mean, in varying degrees. I mean, Saylor talks about this a lot. I mean, particularly within the equities have kind of kept up with inflation. And kind of, inflation is his view, and I think he's a little understates a little bit. That longer term, since 71, inflation has been kind of running at 7% with, various ups and downs. And I think if you look at the S&P returns over that time frame, it's very similar. So stocks, continually earn, they're productive businesses. They grow. They can price things higher as inflation comes along. So stocks tend to perform, give you 7%, and the triple Q, the FANGs and the Magnificent Seven. I mean, some of those stocks were actually kind of digital monopolies, and so they actually did a lot better than the 7%. You could get ahead, owning Microsoft and Google and Facebook and so on and so forth. So there are stocks that will, protect you to some degree from the monetary debasement that occurs. Obviously, the bonds are the biggest loser. Real estate, same story. They're not making any more of it. The government can't print it. The negative on real estate, several negatives in my view. One, you can't move it around. It is where it is, and if the political climate becomes shitty in that environment, well, guess what? You're screwed. And it's very visible, and it's very taxable. And in my generation, a lot of us bought houses cheap in the 80s, and property taxes were low, and those houses went up a lot, and we made good returns on them as an investment. We also lived in it, so it was kind of a twofer. The sad part now is that all these municipal employees have gotten such good economic deals for themselves. The property taxes are just really, really high in most parts of the country, certainly on the coasts and in the bigger cities. Less so in the Midwest and in the more rural areas. But the point is that when you own a property, you don't own it free and clear. The state can tax you on it. One thing you can be sure of is that states and municipalities are going to be looking for tax more and more tax revenue as times get tough. So that's a negative, in my opinion, associated with real estate. It's also less liquid. I mean, if you have a big economic downturn, there are times when, you wouldn't want to have to sell your real estate because, it's a shitty time. When things are booming, there's a very liquid market for most real estate properties. Certainly in the commercial real estate area, it's been terrible. I mean, a lot of these, I mean, Zoom, the thing we're using right now, has more or less, vastly altered the commercial real estate business because, people just don't feel the need to go into an office as much anymore. And so the demand for CRE has dropped quite a bit, and you're seeing all these big buildings getting sold for, 20, 30% of their recent valuations, pre-Zoom. So, but no, those aren't terrible choices, and certainly everybody needs a place to live. And so, I've always advocated owning your house versus renting your house. I mean, some people say all the monetary premium will come out of real estate. I'm not so sure. I mean, I think some of the monetary premium will come out of real estate, but it works, and I think stocks work as well. The thing to remember on stocks, though, is that when economic conditions get rough, they can have 50% drawdowns. I mean, from the peak bubble in 2000, which was really focused on dot-coms, to the bottom, even the S&P went down 50%. From the top of 08 to the bottom of 10 or 11, the S&P went down 50%. Of course, the financials and the housing stocks went down 90%. So, and the stock market right now is not cheap, in my opinion, by any historical measure. It's close to the record excess that was existent in 2020, 1929. So I don't have a lot of stocks that I'm long, other than those which are tied to the commodity theme slash the inflation theme slash the gold and silver theme, the gold and silver miners or the Bitcoin miners. Or Bitcoin. I mean, I think MicroStrategy is a fabulous stock, but to me, you've actually got some assets that, in this set of financial conditions, they're going to perform extremely well, in my view. And that would be, Bitcoin number one, gold and silver is number two and three, or three and two. And at some point in time, things will calm down again, and owning the actual underlying money won't be, it's not going to appreciate as much. You'll want to own productive enterprises. That's coming, but that's a little ways out.
I guess if your base case is like a hyperinflationary event, which I know you haven't expressed, but if it were, having Bitcoin and then physical gold and silver makes more sense, because if you own dollar denominated equities, or you own dollar denominated real estate, bread is still $10,000 a loaf
Well,
or
yeah, I
whatever,
mean,
and that sort of thing.
arguably in a hyperinflationary event, your best assets are, land and bullets and food and water. I mean,
Fair.
in a real societal chaos. But just to give some context, I mean, so let's take the Weimar Germany hyperinflation of 1921 to 23, where, the Deutschmark became worthless. As the study I've done shows, suggests or tells you that if you owned a stock pre that event, like you own shares in Mercedes-Benz, or you own shares in Siemens, or one of the big German industrial companies, there was a time during that event where you might not have gotten paid fairly just because there was so much chaos. The stock market was closed, the currency was hyperinflated, et cetera, et cetera. But if you held on to the shares, eventually on the other side, the Germans returned to a mark that was backed by gold and land, And so, those companies survived and they started making electrical components in Siemens' case, or, automobiles in the Mercedes-Benz case, and they turned into good businesses. And the people who had invested in them got their money back, and did fine. But during the actual hyperinflation event itself, I suspect there were times when they were illiquid and perhaps, they wouldn't have done particularly well. In Venezuela, when they had their hyperinflation, the stock market was one of the best performing stock markets in the world at the time. And yet, if you did it in real terms, it wasn't, because yes, in the bolivar, whatever their currency was, I don't know if it's a peso or bolivar, I can't remember, but it went up, multiples of whatever it was, but that was just because the currency was failing. And so if you adjusted it back to dollars, you didn't do well at all. So yeah, I mean, it's hyperinflationary events are rare, and I don't think that's the base case. But those who suggest it couldn't occur and that it's a complete tail event, I think that's wrong too. We just don't know how it's going to unfold, and we don't know how the authorities are going to behave. But hyperinflations occur when everyone loses confidence in the currency, when it becomes obvious to absolutely everybody that they can never stop printing, that their system is set up so they can never stop printing. And as a result of that, what you saw in Germany was you saw people rushing to buy things. They'd get paid, they'd immediately try and convert their paycheck or the marks they got into something they knew would cost more in 2 days. And that's a crack-up boom, as described by von Mises. So we're seeing a little bit of that now, not a lot, but a little bit. I think most people know that just saving dollars doesn't make sense. They're losing value every year.
Yeah,
So,
definitely. Well, hey, if we could shift gears for one
sure.
question, I assume this is something you've had eyes on. So Marty Bent recently tweeted just in the last couple of days, the U.S. bailing out Japan in an attempt to prevent them from dumping the U.S. treasuries is a signal you should be paying attention to. So can you explain just briefly what the intervention is and what that means exactly? Would you agree with Marty?
Yeah, I totally agree with Marty. Marty's a great guy, by the way. I stole my tagline from him: "Fix the money, fix the world." I think he said it before I did it. But yeah, so what's going on there? So Japan has more debt to GDP than any other country in the world. They've kind of been a leader in this whole MMT movement, and they were kind of able to get away with it because they ran a big trade surplus, and it was a nation of savers, and they would buy their debt, and inflation was very low, and so it all kind of inflation was low in dollar terms, all worked out for them. And they sold automobiles and motorcycles and electronics to the United States, and we sent them dollars. They used those dollars to buy oil. Well, the problem is the price of oil has gone up over time, and for the problem is that their currency has, and people were borrowing in yen to do what was probably the largest financial trade in the world. Very kind of, this is inside baseball, but for most people who aren't financial, but they people were borrowing in yen, knowing that the currency was kind of being, debased, and using the money they got in yen, converting it into another currency, and then buying assets that would yield something. And so, if they could borrow in yen with very low interest rates and buy a yielding asset, it was kind of like a money machine. It was like free money. And by the way, then the yen started to depreciate in value, and that becomes a problem for Japan in the sense that Japan needs to buy oil, because one thing they don't have as an economy is they don't have natural resources. They're stuck on an island in the middle of the Pacific or northern Pacific. So, and they need to buy oil, and they need to buy it in dollar terms. And so, if the yen is depreciating in value, that means they can't convert as many, it takes more yen to buy a certain amount of dollars. And so domestically, their price of oil goes up. And this is why, very interestingly, one of the Saudi princes was rumored, and this guy on Twitter called Craig Shapiro, who I highly recommend everybody follow. One of the Saudi princes went to Japan to talk with them. And my suspicion is what Japan's trying to do is they're trying to get an agreement with the Saudis to pay for their oil in yen. And then the Saudis will use that yen to buy cars and electronics from the Japanese, or if they're smart, they'll convert that yen into gold kind of very quickly as soon as they receive it, because the yen is depreciating in value. But as the yen depreciates in value, what that becomes is it becomes very inflationary for the Japanese people, And of course, the government, knows that if inflation gets too high, they're all going to get voted out of office. They don't want to have that happen. So what they could do is they could intervene and try and buy their yen, buy yen back, so to speak, and support the yen. But to do that, they need money to do that. And Japan is one of the largest holders of U.S. Treasury bonds. I don't know the exact figure on the top of my head. As I recall, it might be around 900 billion. Somebody know that exactly and tell me I'm wrong. But the point is, it's a big number. And so, we recently, it was interesting, we recently talked, there was some talk, I think it was Janet Yellen and others were talking about giving Japan dollar swap lines. And Lynn Alden did a nice tweet on it. We said, we're not really, and these dollar swap lines would basically allow the Japanese to borrow dollars from us at some low cost in order to prevent them from selling our bonds. So, in a sense, by bailing out Japan, we're really not bailing them out as much as we don't want them to sell our treasury bonds. Because if they sell our treasury bonds, our interest rates are going to go up. And if our interest rates are going to go up, that's going to make our fiscal situation worse. And it's our fiscal situation that's driving all of our problems. So, it's all of these things are connected. And all of the central banks and the monetary people around the world, talk to one another, and they're working hard to try and keep the world functioning without there being a blow up or collapse in any given place. And so, this is why we issue swap lines. And a swap line is nothing more than, you can borrow from us and at some cheap rate so that if you're out of money, you don't have to sell those bonds that you hold that are ours, because we don't want you to do that. So yeah, I mean, in a way, again, it's kind of inside baseball, but Japan is a little bit of a canary in the coal mine, right? The fact that the yen is falling, the fact that interest rates are going up there, the fact that inflation is going up there, and the fact that they are the country with the highest debt to GDP ratio. I mean, we're at 125%. I think they're, again, people know the exact number. I don't. I'm just top of my head. I think it's close to 300% debt to GDP. Yeah, government debt. I mean, I think the
Wow.
Japanese, the equivalent of the Japanese Fed, their finance ministry, I've read owns half of their bond market. So I mean this really is just printing to buy their own debt. I mean, and it's there are many who say that if we do have a hyperinflationary event, the most likely first case would be Japan. And I could see that. I'd say it's certainly a possibility. I just don't know. And I've been criticized for saying the word hyperinflation too much, so I try not to go there very often. But the fact of the matter is that the world has become the monetary world has become very distorted and contorted. And to those of us who understand classical economic theory and who realize what it looked like pre-1971, we kind of can't believe what's going on here. I mean, it's just like, they're treating it all like it's monopoly money,
Yeah.
And I mean, somebody on Twitter the other day, a wag, said something like, "Well, here's the good news. The good news is we're all going to be billionaires. The bad news is that's not going to feel so good."
Fair.
Right?
That's probably about, probably seems about right.
Yeah. I mean, nobody wants that, right? Nobody wants the currencies to fail. On the other hand, the way to solve that is to get fiscally responsible. And I haven't seen any evidence that that's coming. So
Yeah. Hey Larry, we're at the top of the hour. Are you good for a couple more
I'm good
minutes
for as
or
long as you'd like to
okay.
go.
All
Sure.
right.
Tell
No,
me.
just a couple more. I thought we'd just round it out with a couple of fun ones. So, besides Bitcoin, you're in another cult. You're a CrossFitter, I think.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's
I'm
right.
curious.
Yeah. It's,
How
what
you
is it, what they say, what is what happens when a vegan and a CrossFitter get together? Which do they talk about first, right?
So I'm just curious. I've got a CrossFit gym 2 minutes from my house. I've never done it. I work out alone. I've got a good gym in my basement. I'm just curious,
Oh, you gotta
what
do it.
your
Oh man,
experience. Okay.
you're gonna get addicted. I mean, so the quick and dirty of it all, that CrossFit, people have been doing this for a while, but I think CrossFit did the best job of bringing it to the mainstream. High intensity interval training, HIIT training, is kind of a, in my opinion, it's a health game changer. Why do I say that? So, we're out when we were, I mean, humans are naturally lazy, and that's okay. If you look at a lot of big predator animals, they are kind of naturally lazy, but they're also able to put out an enormous amount of power and effort for very brief periods of time. And in so doing, you trigger a bunch of hormones and a bunch of internal stuff that, testosterone, all kinds of good stuff that you wouldn't do if you didn't push yourself really hard. And so what CrossFit or HIIT has addressed is the notion that You do a very, very hard amount of work for a very, very short period of time. And the message that sends your body and your brain is, hey, we got to be able to do this shit. We got to, you know, and it gets a lot of chemicals flowing that when you're sedentary, they would just never flow. And, you know, it's very much like, you know, I mean, the lion out on the savannah, you know, he sits there and he lays around all day, but then at some point in time, he sees a gazelle and he does 100% effort to track down the gazelle and kill it so he can eat it. Human beings, the physiology of human beings is very similar. And so, you know, some of the workouts we do are only 5 minutes long, 10 minutes long. Today's was 18 minutes long. But the point is, if you push yourself very hard, and by the way, pushing yourself that hard, I mean, being at your max heart rate, you know, trying to do something for time, it's no fun. I mean, it's uncomfortable. But, you know, the CrossFit line is we're comfortable doing the uncomfortable. But if you can do it, I think what you're going to see is it's going to completely change your life. In terms of mental clarity, in terms of sleep, in terms of how you feel overall, in terms of aging. You know, I'm 66 years old and I feel like I'm 40. Before I started this, I was going downhill fast and I'm still going downhill because, you know, as you just get older, I can't do stuff the way I used to be able to do it because I'm 66. But the point is that this delays it. And so I would highly, highly encourage you to go down there, walk in, you know, tell them your athletic background, say, look, you know, my ma and your major thing, your major concern is you don't want to get injured, right? You just, and you need really good coaching and you need to scale things in the early days. But, you know, they need to let you have a little fun. They need to let you push it. And so, if you do that, what you find is it becomes really addictive. You kind of think to yourself, originally, you think, oh gosh, this is hard and it hurts. Pretty soon, you know, I get to the stage where now if I don't do it, I really miss it because it's what makes me feel good. You know, it gets all the endorphins flowing. So that's the case for CrossFit. I really, you know, and it's the other thing is it's very varied. I mean, before I did CrossFit, I ran, which is boring. I would go to the gym and lift, which can be boring. You know, this is very, it's very varied. There are probably 30 different movements, and every day is different. And there's nothing worse than, okay, I'm going to go to the gym, I'm going to do bench presses again. You know, I'm tired of doing the bench. I mean, here we got, you know, 20 different lifts. We got running, we got wall balls, we got box jumps, got all kinds of shit. And we got jump rope. We're gonna just mix and match it. And so there's no 2 days look alike. And so it creates a very balanced kind of fitness where, you know, you've got explosiveness, you've got the ability to go long, you've got the ability to lift. You know, you're not necessarily the best lifter, you're not necessarily the best runner, you're not necessarily the most explosive person, but you maintain air skills in all of those areas. And so, you know, and to me, I don't think there's a system even close to CrossFit, you know, for providing that. And I think it could really change everybody's life. The book that I recommend to friends, and I'll say it on your show, because I think it's a very important book. If you turn 40, 45, and you haven't read Younger Next Year, you're really missing it. So Younger Next Year was written by a guy named Cowell, I think it is. Chris, I can't remember the guy's name, but Google it. Younger Next Year. You'll find it. Two authors. And the bottom line is, it's a book about a guy who was fat and out of shape in his 60s in New York City. He went to his doctor, and his doctor said, you're going to die. You know, you're a blob and you're going to die. And so he went and he researched, you know, physical fitness because he was kind of crazy about anything he did. And he found a kind of a HIIT-like alternative. It was pre-CrossFit. And he started doing it. And he just said, you know, and he, you know, he's now 80 and he's in super fit and in great shape and he's extended the quality of his life immeasurably. And, you know, this is a book that everyone who's 40 or 50 needs to read because, you know, in my case, what happened is you get to a stage, you know, when you're a young guy like you, or just in general, you know, as a guy, it's very easy to say, my job is to make money and protect my family, right? And yeah, if I don't work out a lot, well, I'd like to work out, but if I don't, no big deal. Well, guess what? When you get to be 50, you know, you've probably done an okay job of protecting your family and, you know, providing for yourself economically. And at that point in time, you're fighting against time. And, you know, I know guys who are 65, they look like they're 85. And then there are guys who are 66 like me, and they're, you know, I feel like I'm 40. And so basically working out becomes your job. I mean, to me, it's actually more important than, you know, investing or the fund I run or anything else I do. It's at the top of my list of things that I want to do to keep myself, you know, around for the next 30 years. So, and that's the way it kind of has to be. You know, I mean, it's, it, and it's, mean, I think, most healthcare professionals would tell you this too. I mean, everyone says exercise more. I mean, exercise is by far the best drug out there for longevity. I mean, just there's nothing even close. But you can't just, you can't go to the gym, lift a few weights, come home and say you've exercised. I had a friend at CrossFit who was a doctor, and he said people would come into him and say, "Oh yeah, I exercised today." And the guy would say, my friend, the CrossFitter would doctor would say, "Well, how sweaty did your shirt get?" Like, "Well, not very sweaty. I just," he said, "you didn't exercise today." I mean, if you didn't get up to 80% of your max heart rate for some period of time, you didn't exercise. I mean, and so if you want a system for doing that, and it will help you along, it's very understanding. The coaches are very good. Nobody walks in the door fit. They're there to help you get fit and to make you feel good about it too. That's the other thing. There's nothing negative about it. I mean, people come in, they perform horribly. Everyone high fives them. Like, they're just anyone who's willing to walk through the door is accepted into this community. So that's kind of a long-winded answer on CrossFit, but I really feel very strongly about it. And I really highly encourage anyone listening to this to find a good CrossFit box in their area to walk in and describe their situation. And I think if the CrossFit box is good, what they will say to you. I went into the one I went into, and I said, it was a very good one, by the way. And I said, "Look, I'm pretty fat, I'm pretty out of shape. Can you get me fit?" And they said, "Yeah, we've seen much worse, but yeah, we can." And then I said, "Okay, what do I got to do?" And I said, "You got to keep walking through the door. I mean, in other words, this isn't a one day a week or a 2 day a week thing. You got to show up here 5 fucking days a week. You got to walk through the door 5 days a week. And some days you'll feel like shit and the workout won't be that easy, or you'll dog it, but you walk through the door. And what you'll see is if, after a month of walking through the door, you'll notice a difference. After 3 months of walking through the door, you'll notice a bigger difference. A year of walking through the door, you'll be a completely different person. I mean, you'll have lost, 10 or 15 pounds of fat. You'll be stronger. You'll be sleeping better. You'll be mentally clearer. I mean, all of that. It's just like, holy shit, how did this happen? Well, it happened because you walked through the door. So that's my pitch for CrossFit.
That's great. No, I love, I think I heard something recently. It's like 90s, some crazy percentage of 30-year-olds never sprint again or never jump again or whatever. And that's not,
Nuts.
I play rec basketball, indoor
There you go.
soccer, and I work out, but it's sort of scary to think that, eventually when I'm 45, I'm probably not going to be playing some of the things that I
You got to be careful on the basketball. A lot of injuries from that.
True, true. I've had my share of injuries from that, but yeah, no, I think it'd be interesting to have something that would keep
Go
me.
down there and do it, and then let me know what you think. I'm telling you, man, it'll change your life. It really will.
So, hey, last question for you. Just any general predictions for Bitcoin over the next 12 to 18 months? It could be price, could be
My view
anything.
is this, we look, I mean, not that long ago, we were at 15, and then we kind of bounced around. We were at 25, 30. Now we're kind of 66 or something, or mid-60s. I tend to believe, that we'll be in the 100 plus range, not that far away. And that next year, if the halving cycle kind of past repeats, I think there's a very good chance we'll run to 150, 200, 250. And maybe at 250 it'll be ahead of itself. I don't know. I mean, there are those who believe we're going to go right into hyper Bitcoinization. I don't. I think that, I think that at some point in time it'll retrace back. But the drawdowns have become not as steep, and the monetary debasement is, in my opinion, accelerating. So that would argue for higher than a couple hundred. But look, I was, I'm very bad at short-term predictions. I feel much more comfortable with my long-term prediction that these will be worth $1 million a coin, not that far out. I mean, within a 3 to 5 year window, and that they'll probably be worth. I mean, they tend to kind of 10x. It tends to 10x every 4 or 5 years. So, it went from 600 to, I don't know, 6,000. Then it went from, 6,000 to 60,000, it's going to go to 600,000, then it's going to go to 6 million. I mean, this is per coin. So, I personally think we're going to see 1 million, 2 million, 3 million, $4 million a coin in the next 10 years. So easily. And, but how you get there, I mean, it'll have the same volatility, less decreasing over time, but it will be volatile. We know that because it has been volatile. And there'll be, there's the other side's trying to use FUD to scare people off from it. But, it just keeps marching along. I mean, I was pleased to see the state of Wisconsin's buying some, right? I mean, it's just, they're every day, every week, every month, there are more addresses, more adoption, more buyers. And it really is the best money ever invented, the best form of money ever invented. And so with that kind of as a backdrop, I think ultimately one day we'll all be paying for things in sats. But that's quite a ways away. I mean, I don't, the dollar is going to be around for quite some time. But I don't think anybody will be saving in dollars in 5 or 10 years. Everyone will know that it's just a transaction medium. So.
I think you're probably right. Larry, hey, thank you so much for your time. Hey, why don't you give a handoff where to find you,
Oh,
your
sure.
acronym?
So, well, I'm on Twitter under my name, Lawrence Lepard, at Lawrence Lepard. There are a lot of fakes too. Don't fall for those. Make sure you get the guy with 160,000 followers and my name is spelled correctly. All these people misspell my name. Hope that people are going to follow. Don't ever, I won't DM you asking you. I mean, it's a couple of people have gotten fooled by people fake DMs. And then I have a fund that I manage that's Bitcoin Gold Fund. And it's at a website called EMA2. Edward Mark Alpha, the number 2.com. At the bottom of that website, you can sign up for my quarterly letters. They're also on the website, so you can click through and get them. Every quarter, my partner and I write a letter that kind of describes what we think is going on in the macroeconomic world. And the most recent one is good, I think. I mean, we captured, I mean, there's a headline in there. US debt went up $1 trillion in 100 days. Yeah, right. I mean, a
Wild.
$1 trillion of debt was added in 100 days, which implies at that rate that the debt's going up $3.65 trillion a year, which is close to 10% growth in the debt, more than 10% growth in the debt, and the economy is growing at 3 or 4%. I mean, it's going to break, Michael. I mean, this is going to break, and I'm so highly confident of that, but I can't tell you if it's going to happen tomorrow or it's going to happen in 2 years. I just don't know the answer to that. But I do know that the trend is continual monetary debasement, and people who are saving need to save in something the government can't print. And we know what the choices are. So.
That's right. Larry, hey, thank you so much. You
Oh,
are
thank you. It's really
a
pleasant to
joy
be
to
with you.
speak with. And yeah, look
Yeah.
forward to sending this episode out to everyone so they can get as excited about seeing your name on a
Oh gosh,
podcast as
I don't know why, but
I do.
as long as people keep asking me to talk, I like to talk, so I'll do
I
it.
love it. I love it. Thank you so much, Larry. Cheers.
Thank you, Mike. Take care. Bye.
And that's a wrap. Again, I appreciate you being here. I think Larry does as good a job as anyone articulating some of the challenges, as I said. And it is true that if I see his name on a podcast, I'm listening to it very quickly. So it was an honor to speak with him personally. Check him out online, follow him on X. He's got some great commentary. And of course, if you need help with Bitcoin self-custody, if you want to better secure your home network, if you want a Plan B residency option, the Bitcoin Way is your source. Go to thebitcoinway.com/podcast. And you can also follow us on X at thebitcoinway underscore. If you want to reach out to me personally, I'm on Twitter X at the other M Jordan. You can reach out to me with comments, questions, critiques, whatever it is. I am happy to hear it. I'm still figuring all this out. Would really appreciate it. And then my personal Bitcoin newsletter is blackhatbitcoin.substack.com. So check it out there if you're interested in Bitcoin fundamentals. And until next time, this is Michael Jordan signing off.